Well, I'm Diego David from Los Alamos. I'm interested in this talk, in cosmic physics, quantum information, and also on experiments with cosmic physics. I collaborate with Onofrio and Steve LaMoureux. Okay, so today I'm gonna give a talk on the cosmic physics of atom surface interactions. It's gonna be some parts which are review-like, some parts which are a little bit new. And for those of you who were either in Leipzig last year or in Brasília this year, you almost saw everything here. So this is new for those who were not there. So this work is basically a theoretical work done in collaboration with Paulo, who's here, and with the French group of Astrid, Ricardo, and Serge Renaud. So we're gonna have three parts to talk. The first part, I will give a review of the theory and experiments on Casimir physics in atom surface interactions. I guess in this program there were, I think, only one talk by De Quivet, who talked about this, so I want to give kind of a further review, more on the experimental side. Then the second part is I want to talk about something which is not my work. This is courtesy of Marwan Tezza from the Gila-Trento collaboration on the first measurements of temperature effects in Casimir physics done with BECs at the Cornell experiment. And so the transparencies are due to Mauro, who kindly gave them to me for Brazil, and I decided to present them here too. And then the last part is my own work with some people here on this scattering approach to Casimir physics in atom surface interactions and how to probe non-trivial effects of geometry with atoms beyond the usual PFA or pairwise summation approximations. So yeah, I promise this is not going to be an hour and a half talk, so I'm going to be fast. So first of all, let's talk about kind of a review thing. So as you all know, in Fourier, Casimir and Polder predicted that if you have an atom, let's take here a ground state atom that we can model as a two-level atom with a dynamical polarizability alpha, so how the atom responds to an applied electric field, either fluctuating or real, in proximity to a surface, there is an interaction between the surface and the atom, and the interaction energy depends on the position of the atom above the surface, and it's given by a frequency integral of some response of the atom, which is this polarizability of the atom, times the trace of the green function of a surface of electromagnetic field in the presence of this boundary condition. Okay? And so this is one possible way of writing this Casimir interaction. From now on, I will talk in general as Casimir-Polder force, but it has different limits. So one limit will be van der Waals, and the other limit is Casimir-Polder. In general, we'll call it Casimir-Polder. Some other people prefer to call it generally van der Waals. So what are these two guys? Well, first thing here, if you have a multi-level atom, the polarizability is given by the matrix elements of the electric dipole of the atom, which has these k levels. And so you can calculate this, which is a very complicated object to calculate, or you can measure that. And the other object that you have to calculate, and which is all what we are talking in these talks about, this TG, TG, and so on, is how to calculate this green tensor, which is a solution to the standard equations for Maxwell, with a medium that has some given electrical polarizability. So you have to solve this equation plus the corresponding boundary conditions. And this problem, usually it's almost impossible to solve exactly unless you have some particular geometries. So for example, if you have a ground state atom above a surface which is plane and it's at zero temperature, well, I don't know if you can see on the bottom, but you have, yeah, there's no way to move it, I guess. You can calculate explicitly this guy, this green function, And therefore, you can plug this into this equation and study two different limits analytically. One limit is what's called the non-retarded or van der Waals limit, where the distance between the atom and the plane is much smaller than the typical wavelength of absorption of the atom and any wavelength of a material. So Z should be much smaller than, for example, any plasma wavelength. And in that case, the interaction energy scales like 1 over distance to the third power, and then the information on the atom and the surface is contained in this frequency integral. Okay? So this is a standard van der Waals limit, which can be interpreted as interaction between a classical dipole, fluctuating dipoles, without any retardation between of the light going from the atom to the surface and back. Yeah, I'm assuming isotropic surface, zero temperature, and isotropic atom, S waves, and so on. This formula is for zero temperature. You can easily generalize it to finite temperature. Now, in the other limit, when the atom is very, very, very far away, so distance is much small, much larger than absorption wavelengths or plasma wavelengths, you go into the Casimir-Polder limit, where you have you get an extra power of distance, so z to the fourth, and then the information on the atom and the surface enters through the static polarizability and the static dielectric constant. Okay, and this phi is a function that you can, well, I think Jaloszynski, Pitaevsky, and calculate this analytical formula for this function phi.
Do you have an intuitive explanation why it's 1 over distance cubed in the non-retard limit and 1 over distance fourth in the case there?
Well, I think this one you can just is fluctuating dipoles, it's just electrostatics.
I think when retarded is easier to interpret because the polarizability alpha is proportional to the volume. In order to match an energy, you need 1 over z to the fourth. And the other one is involves the scale. And
it's the same.
Yeah, therefore.
Right.
Therefore, you take 1 z away and then replace it by scale.
What?
That's
always
interesting. What's intuitive?
Yeah, I don't know if it's intuitive, but.
Sorry, a philosophy professor said it's what you've been tutored in that makes you.
You think it's intuitive, right? Okay. So as I said, all this is at zero temperature. In a few transparencies, I will talk what happens when you have finite temperature in this problem. In particular, there will be a new law for when the distance is much larger than the typical thermal wavelength. So what are the experiments that people have done? So the first experiment, well, not the first, but the first modern experiment was done by Heinz, at Heinz Group, when he was in Yale. And basically, what you have is like, so instead of having two parallel plates, you have a wedge here, metallic wedge, and you have an atomic beam of sodium atoms going there through the wedge, and because of the Casimir-Polder attraction, the beam will be deflected. Okay, so some atoms will be deflected, will strike onto the plates, and the assumption that was done in this experiment was that the atoms that were colliding onto the wedge would be permanently stuck to the wedge, so they will not reflect. Okay, some other atoms will go through, and what you measure here with a detector is the transmission. Okay, so by measuring transmission, knowing how many atoms went through and how many atoms went in, you can calculate the potential. Well, I mean, you can have a theory for the potential and you fit with experimental data. So the typical distance between the atom and the plates was around 1 micron. And so this is a potential energy as a function of position, lateral position here. So this is an expression in the Casimir-Polder limit. I think this is from Barton, right? Yeah.
And Barton has it for sure.
Yeah. Felipe has now some exact calculations for this geometry. And the agreement between theory and experiment was around 10%. So there was a confirmation of this Casimir-Polder prediction.
This is in the
retarded region.
There was work at Columbia in the Bureau of Standards in the early 1970s. Non-retarded limit.
Right. I mean, there are lots of I'm going to basically talk about here more the experiments on the retarded regime. Yeah, there are lots of Van der Waals, yeah.
What's the position Z is in the perpendicular direction or?
This position? Yeah, this is the position, so you have the plate here, you have the atom, is this position.
Okay.
Well, the following experiments are were by the ASPECT group in France.
Why do you take such a geometry?
I mean, ideally, we would like to have a. I think it's because they could control in with great accuracy the angle, and therefore with great accuracy the distance. Okay. I mean, one could think of doing this parallel plate, but then the issue is how to keep parallelism. So the next experiments were done related to classical reflection of atoms close to surfaces. So the idea here is that you have a prism, you have a laser that you put in total internal reflection, then you have some evanescent field, okay? And so there is a field, a non-homogeneous field that the atom sees, okay? So then you have a mode. So a bunch of atoms, cold atoms, that you release, so they will go down, okay? But when they go down, they will see two fields. So one is this the field created by the evanescent wave, which is a kind of a dipolar field that you can control the sign by changing this delta, which is a detuning between the frequency of the laser and the frequency of the atoms, okay? So you can change the sign of this guy, make it attractive or repulsive. And since it is spatially varying, it will produce a gradient of a field, therefore a force on the atom. So this is a standard dipole force. And then, because it gets closer to the surface, it will also feel a Casimir Polder or Van der Waals force, depending on how far away it is from the surface.
Epsilon
here is the electric permittivity of the glass. The prism. It's a function. Yeah, here I'm assuming. Yeah, it's a center frequency. In fact, there should be kind of an integral of this guy in frequency. I'm just giving a simple expression.
So not
a vacuum. Permittivity of vacuum.
So it's not the same. No. Yes, it was previously.
Sorry, but. So the idea with this is that since you can play with this sign here, you can make this attractive or repulsive, so you can have a competition of the two potentials. So if you sum the two, you have this kind of repulsive, so this is a potential versus distance, vertical distance. You have the possibility of having completely repulsion, or some repulsive bump, and then an attractive tail. Okay, so by measuring, by playing with these parameters, one can see that the atom is coming and then reflecting. Okay, by measuring this as a function of k, so function of velocity of the atoms, you can infer what the Van der Waals Casimir Polder potential was. And the agreement was reasonable with theory. Now, once people were able to cool atoms much further down in temperature and get diseases, in fact.
When you say theory now, they're also doing the spectra of the materials so that they know really that epsilon is going with the material in their experiment?
I think, well, I really don't remember exactly the details, but I'm pretty sure that they take just the static polarizability of the permittivity of the material. I would be surprised that. Yeah, in more recent experiments, people are taking into account the frequency dependency, and as I will talk later on. So now suppose you have atoms which are much, much slower, and this you can do with BCs, okay? So in the nano-Kelvin regime, and the idea is that you have the phenomena of quantum reflection. Okay, so suppose now you don't have any of these evanescent waves, so you only have the attractive potential due to Casimir Polder or Van der Waals. If the atom goes very, very slow, due to quantum mechanics, it's possible that although the potential is attractive, the atom is reflected from the surface. Okay, it doesn't never reach the surface, but it's reflected. And this is a what's known as quantum reflection. So suppose that we have an atom at infinity, which a given momentum k0, and it goes towards the surface. So the surface produces a potential u. So this is the effective momenta of the atom as a function of position, because u is a function of position. Okay. So the idea is that if this k varies rapidly enough, okay, then the wave function has some probability of being reflected. Okay. So there's an effective reflection. And this happens for potentials, well, I'm just telling you the result, right? That vary with distance like this, 1 over r to the n with n bigger than 2. Okay, so Casimir, Polder, or van der Waals is one of such potentials, so in principle one should be able to see quantum reflection. And people have seen quantum reflection, starting with Shimizu with cold atoms, and then Ketterle, well, Shimizu and the Kivet with cold atoms, and Ketterle with BCs. So this is a picture of a BC trapped in a harmonic trap, I think it was a magnetic trap, and then you put the BC to oscillate, okay? The way to do that is basically you suddenly move the trap, so the BC will start sloshing, then you release it, and then the BC will go towards the surface, and the surface in his case was a bunch of nanopillars, silicon nanopillars, and you can study reflection on the, and the theory more or less agrees well with the experiment. So, and finally, what I want to talk is more what will be related to this talk in particular is the recent experiment by Eric Cornell. And the idea is to use a BEC as a kind of an AFM cantilever. So you put a BEC, well, obviously you cannot see it, but here is a cell in vacuum, and inside the cell you have different materials, for example, fusilica, sapphire, BK7 glass, and also here experiments with metals. And then you put your BEC close to the surface, you make it oscillate, and you see how the oscillation frequency changes as you approach the surface. Because there is a force on the BEC, the frequency of oscillation of the BEC by itself will be changed to a new frequency when you have a surface nearby. So they measure this relative frequency shift, which is given as a second derivative of the Casimir-Polder potential, since you are able to watch the center of motion, the motion of the center of mass of the BEC for a long time, many, many seconds, you can get a very good estimation of a frequency. And from there, measuring this guy, you can infer what the Casimir-Polder potential is. So I'll talk a little bit later on more about this. So this is the end of this introductory part.
The density of this gas is so low that you can just assume that it's additive.
Yeah. It's coming in a few slides. So the following slides are related to this thermal measurement, thermal Casimir-Polder measurement, and I would like to thank again Mauro and Tetsa for them. So this is the idea of a Pitarovsky, Stringari, and Tetsa paper. So suppose you have this cell, which is in a given temperature, which call them the environmental temperature TE. Then we have a surface, which is with a certain temperature TS, and imagine that you can control them both separately, okay? And then you have an atom, okay? And the atom has a temperature, well, and the atom has some levels, structure levels, but we assume that the frequency of absorption of the atom is much, much larger than all these temperatures. Therefore, we can assume that the atom is always in the ground state. Okay, so we'll just be like a probe. There will be no dynamics in the atom. Okay, now the question is, what is the force on the atom due to the surface in the presence of these two environmental temperatures? In Casimir, usually we think that these two guys are the same, okay? But in this setup, it's possible to control them separately, and this was the idea of their experiment. So in principle, I mean, the force on the atom is just the gradient of the field times the total electric dipole on the atom, and you can split it in two parts. One is induced dipole times the fluctuating field, and the other is the fluctuating dipole times the induced field. And what they showed, and again, I'm not deriving this, I'm just telling you the result, is that if you are at equilibrium, meaning that the temperature of the environment is the same as the temperature of the surface, you have this force at very large distances. So before we had van der Waals, then we had Casimir Polder, and then for distances much larger than the thermal wavelength, we have this thermal force which goes linearly in temperature and 1 over distance to the fourth, and again depends on the static optical information of the atom and the surface. But if you have out of equilibrium, apart from this force, you also have this contribution, and the important thing is that it depends on the difference of the squares of the temperature of the substrate and the environment. So in principle, if you can choose them separately, you can change the sign of this guy and make the force repulsive just by temperature. And don't ask me if I have an intuition, because I don't on this.
There is an explanation for this. It's associated with the fact that the density of state can be split into two parts. The part which is relevant for this formula is the Vanishing part for the Vanishing wave. And if you have a look at the density of energy, it goes with the temperature, and it gives this behavior. All
right. But is that intuitive?
There is none. But you know, the intuition that I have is just when you have a look at the density of energy.
All right.
Epsilon 0 is the
gain. Yeah, I'm using
static
electric constant.
Substrate. So if that tends to 1, let's say if I take instead of the substrate, also kind of.
You mean vacuum?
No, just diluted system. So then there must be another crossover length scale, right? There is a divergence in the amplitude. So does it mean that ultimately very large separations, larger than some crossover related to this epsilon, being getting close to 1, one has a crossover to the 1 over?
Yeah, I think so. I think so, but I think so. I'm not completely sure. I should think about it. No, because he says that this, if you take epsilon 0 very close to 1, this explodes, right?
Epsilon 0 in this case, it was just the vacuum
polarity. No. Here is a static polarizability. The vacuum always enters like a. I mean, they do things in CGS in this paper by Mauro.
But I guess the point is that the responsible of this PM was some grazing waves at the surface. And for those grazing waves, the epsilon is always not diluted. It's quite. It's not. It cannot go to 1.
If epsilon 0 is what I think it is, then it can go to 1.
Yeah. I mean, what should we read? I mean, the derivation of this formula to see if one can take that limit.
I think there must be another crossover.
Yeah.
If I set T equal to 0 so that just the substrate has temperature, is there some way of interpreting the radiation pressure from the substrate?
As this, I think so, yeah.
Why isn't it TS to the fourth power?
The best way to answer this question is to have a look at it. But I guess again that when you have a difference in temperature between the substrate and the environment, there is some strange cancellation that doesn't work, and then normally they work when you have the equilibrium state, but we cannot really make some prediction starting from the equilibrium state to get to the non-equilibrium state. So probably the power law, and there are some strange cancellation.
It would have also the wrong sign.
Sorry?
It would have the wrong sign.
Right.
Yeah. It's for radiation pressure.
Then it would be
radiation attraction.
No, no.
Yeah, but wait a minute. In the T to the fourth, I mean, don't you assume that you have thermal equilibrium?
Well, the substrate is in equilibrium at temperature Ts, right?
What is an equilibrium? It's
but what's
temperature?
But it's
you're pumping heat over
completely contained.
Yeah, there's sun. It's different. There's sun. It radiates through vacuum, and we get at the Earth radiation. And we can calculate that radiation as temperature of the sun raised to the fourth.
The radiation pressure of the sun of the moon is in the order, it would shift the moon in a year. Something in the order of.
I know. I mean.
I guess
this calculation is assuming thermal local thermal equilibrium in every place.
No, but the Stefan Boltzmann law and the radiation from the sun, you don't need to assume that the vacuum is in the same temperature as the sun.
Right.
That's true, but I guess there is, if you compute exactly this expression, there are some other parts which are L independent, and one of these is the 10 to the 4th.
Yes, yes.
Yes, and they argue for two plates, it cancels with the other.
Okay, we should. Because this is not my work, so I.
The idea is you're doing work while you're watching this out of the equilibrium, and part of that work is to create this force.
But I mean, here's.
Feeding. I have to maintain these temperatures.
Right.
If something moves in the meantime, I have to do something still to keep those temperatures, right?
Well, but I mean, you mean moving the atom moving? Well, I mean, but the atom is just a probe. I mean, it's just so tiny that it doesn't change at all the temperatures of the two systems.
Right, you're just trying to make it live in a gradient, don't you?
Exactly. Exactly.
And in a sense, you're doing that work. It's feeling the gradient. Feel the work you're doing on it, but surely that's what you mean when you say that equilibrium. You're creating a gradient
of temperature.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so, they have measured this in 97, and the idea again is to use this BEC, as I was telling before. So, as Thorsten said, the BEC is so dilute that in fact it's a collection of n atoms. Each of them feels the force individually, and you can do a pairwise summation of this force. So, why a BEC? The idea is that BEC is a compact object, very well controlled, with very, very low total momentum. So, it's a very good clock, if you want. For this type of measurements, okay? But I mean, in all these measurements, the fact that the BEC is a superfluid, has some coherence and all that, is irrelevant. Okay, there's nothing of the quantum coherence of the BEC used for these ideas. It's just that it's a good object for measuring frequency.
The Eric Cornell experiment?
Yeah. So basically, okay, so in you can have the BEC trapped in an optical trap or in a magnetic trap. In Cornell's case, was in a magnetic trap, was very asymmetric, so you have an elongated BEC in one direction, so kind of a cigar, and it's oscillating with its own frequency of the trap. Now you move this guy close to the surface, and because of this Casimir-Polder interaction, there will be a change of the total potential, therefore a change of a frequency. So at lowest order, you can calculate what's the new curvature of this parabola close to the minimum, and you can measure that with this BEC acting as a good clock. So this was the original idea of them, and so this is what I just said. You have this optical or magnetic harmonic trap. The BEC is oscillating in this trap, and then you approach to the surface, and therefore you have a shift in the frequency of oscillation that is given by a sum over all the atoms. So this is where you use this pairwise summation, so to speak, because the BEC is very dilute, and it's the second derivative of the potential, so it's the curvature, and you can study corrections to this, which you can calculate also. So the idea is, if you measure the center of mass as a function of time, okay, you can measure the frequency shift, and that's it.
So how many periods do they have? They have quite a few periods to measure?
The frequency was around, I think, 100 hertz, around in the 100 hertz, and this was that for seconds.
Okay. So they didn't have to worry about leaking towards the surface or anything like that?
There are many issues. I mean, one is those, because it depends on what surface you use. They show that if you use metallic surfaces, the atoms get absorbed into the surface. So when they are there, they create local fields, local permanent dipole fields. And these are much larger than the Casimir polar, so they can see nothing. So they couldn't do experiments with metals. They had to do it with dielectrics. The bad thing of dielectrics, not in this context, but in the usual context of, well, you know better than I do, in Casimir experiments, typical Casimir, so bulk, is that you put a potential difference. But then you have all charges going around, and therefore it's impossible to do calibrations, right? But here the measurement is not through capacitance or a Coulomb measurement, okay? So in this sense, they don't have to worry about those issues. And also your probe is uncharged, right? So it's a neutral atom, so it doesn't see static. Let me feel.
Do you have to integrate over all particles? Does each one of them oscillate by themselves, or are they all oscillating together?
Well, all oscillate together, but each of them feels a
different force. So the BDC nature is important that all of them are coherent.
Yes. Okay. Well, in fact, I mean, this is a dipole, what's called a dipole oscillation of the BDC, and it's shape invariant, so the shape always stays the same, and it's a good collective motion of the BDC because it's completely uncoupled to the environment. Okay.
If you had a classical cloud,
we'll do whatever.
Because it's a coherent cloud, they all do.
Exactly. Right.
This is only measuring the gradient of the force, right?
This measures the gradient of the force, yes. There are other measurements. Okay, sorry, and the information also the BDC is in this formula for the density, which is here assuming it's the Thomas Fermi approximation, so basically the density is a parabolic density starting from the center and maximum value and then going down, okay? So here, I mean, to derive this, you also assume that it's in the strong interacting regime of the BDC. So this measures gradients of the force, as David said, but other possibilities of measuring directly the force. I'm not going to talk about that. Well, I'm going to talk about here. But one possibility is replacing bosons, these BCs, by fermions in an optical lattice. This idea by the Inguccio group in Florence. So you put the optical lattice perpendicular to the surface, and you put your fermions on the lattice, and you measure what's called Bloch oscillations, and those oscillations are directly proportional to the force. Okay? And then there are other ideas that I'm going to talk later on different experiments you could do.
So what's the Fermi nature? You can get block oscillations in bosons too.
Yeah, also in bosons. Yeah, they discuss both cases. Okay, so these are, sorry. So again, I mean, this is the force. Okay, so gradient of the potential versus distance for different cases when you have equilibrium, so both temperatures the same, system and environment at zero temperature, ambient temperature 600, you always have a negative here, meaning that you always have attraction. But here, if you can have different temperatures of system and environment, you can go into a regime of repulsion. Okay? So this is theory. So this is experiment, and I have to be a little bit faster, I guess. So again, you have this BC, which is a very elongated cigar shape, close to the surface. You make it oscillate perpendicular to the surface, so you put it like that, okay? Then you approach, and you see how the frequency of oscillation changes as a function of distance. And the way you measure distance in these experiments, as different from the usual Casimir, is that you do grazing incidence of a resonant laser, so you see the BEC and its image, so the distance between the BEC and the surface is half of the distance between the two images. That's how you do the calibration, absolute calibration of distance. Okay, and then they heated one of the surfaces, so the substrate surface, by a laser that they also calibrated interferometrically, and these are the results. So this is frequency shift as a function of distance. Look that they did it for very large distances, 7 to 10 microns, which is huge as compared to typical Casimir experiments. And the temperatures are these ones. So always the temperature of a surface is above the temperature of environment. The environment always has ambient temperature, and therefore always you have attraction. So they have not measured repulsion yet. Well, yeah, I think they will not do it because they dismantled the experiment, but so it's only measuring attraction. And the theory agrees very well with the experiments. And this is a reference. So now I'm going to move to a different subject. So,
what did that do to that dielectric constant? For the surface, did they use bike dielectric constants or?
Did they use, sorry, what?
For the surfaces.
Yeah, they use a fused silica, and they use optical data for fused silica taken from Palik's book. And
because I remember there is a paper preprint out by Master Panenko who claims that if you take the residual charge carriers into account, you overestimate, theory overestimates.
There is an ongoing debate on how to interpretation. Maybe we can talk about that later on personally. Also, I mean, there is a discussion whether you have to put a charge screening or not, or DC conductivity or not in all these experiments.
I guess it's not that important. I don't know exactly, but I guess that does not influence this experiment that much.
Yeah. I mean,
influence of relative.
No, as far as I know, the absolute data here. I mean, there are no free parameters in this fitting of the theory to the experiment, and the theory has been done taking into account just a static.
But not the DC conductivity.
Right, no DC conductivity. Right. But then I mean, recently in PRL appeared three papers. One of them is mine, regarding the importance of taking into account charge screening in these kind of experiments. And the case here is that the surface is silicon, a fused silica, which has a huge device screening length, and probably for these kind of systems, the effects of charge screening is also negligible. He's doing an experiment with germanium, intrinsic germanium, and in that case, probably the effect of screening will be more important.
So this, I'm still getting, the form of the fitting you're using is the finite temperature format.
It's finite temperature format with a non-equilibrium, so with these two different temperatures.
So when you have this long a distance, and I'm usually thinking retardation, things like this, this is all in the calculation when you...
Yes. Something you should point out, that this is a real first demonstration of temperature effects in Casimir physics. Because so far, in the usual bulk measurements, nobody has been able to measure temperature effects. Because these are important at large separations, and typical experiments don't have sensitivity beyond 2 microns.
Right. There are measurements, of course, with aqueous systems where you can turn the temperature-dependent part on and off by changing salts.
Right.
I mean, there's a way to see these temperature-dependent terms.
Right. But in the Casimir regime, or in the Casimir, in the retarded regime also?
Well, I mean, it's not much. That's what that is. It's the zero frequency term.
Okay.
So,
right. Okay.
I mean, it's the real Casimir test.
Right.
Just down to the very lowest. I mean, the really long distance limit is again a non-retarded form, isn't it?
Right.
The one people are asking about.
Right.
So that does come into this calculation.
Okay.
This is a very long distance.
It is.
Yeah, this is a long distance limit.
That's exactly.
Yeah. But it's amazing that they have sensitivity to go through such large separations.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the rest of the talk, I'm going to talk about my work. So the idea is basically to use these BECs as a tool for measuring some geometrical non-trivial effects. Okay? So I'm gonna, since we heard so many talks about scattering, TG, and so on, I want to put all this atom surface interaction into that context. So again, suppose you have a general surface with some local profile H, and you have your atom, and they interact via fluctuating electromagnetic fields. So you have an incoming field towards the surface, you have outgoing fields. Because the surface has a non-trivial profile and non-trivial conductivity properties, upon reflection it can change the polarization P from P prime to P, it can change the transverse momentum, so this case momentum along the plane, but since the surface is static it doesn't change the frequency. So, I mean, if you take this plane here, you can define TE and TM polarizations with respect to that plane. You can define unit polarization vectors, both for output fields like this one and for input fields like this one. And the input and the output are related through a reflection matrix of the surface. So this R is a reflection matrix that connects different case and different polarizations. So it's possible to show that the interaction energy between the atom and the surface at zero temperature is given by this expression. So it's an integration over frequency of the trace of the log 1i minus the reflection matrix of the surface, some displacement operator that displaces from z equals 0 to z of the atom, some reflection operator of the atom, and then another displacement. So this is kind of a TG formula where T is the reflection matrix of the surface and of the atom, and the G's are this translation from one coordinate system to the other coordinate system. So this K operator, in this case, it's easy to calculate in the plane wave basis, and it's diagonal, and it's given by this standard formula. Okay, so the only thing we need to do, well, the only thing is to calculate the two reflection matrices. So first of all, let's do the easy part, or more or less easy part, which is calculating the reflection matrix of the atom. So we are going to put the coordinate system anywhere, so this will be valid for any position of the atom. And one, so you have the atom, you have incoming fields from the left, so coming from the surface. So the there will be an induced dipole proportional to the total electric field via the polarizability. So the atom will radiate as a dipole. So some radiation will come back to the surface, which is this one, and some radiation will go to the right, so it's a transmitted radiation. So you can calculate the amplitude of the electric field of the dipole going back to the surface, which is this one. And then it's easy to replace the electric dipole of the field of the dipole of the atom in terms of the total field. Okay, so you put this into here, and then you only consider the incoming field on the atom, and therefore you get this expression. So this expresses the radiated field of the dipole towards the surface as a function of the incoming field on the dipole, and from here it's immediate to read what the matrix elements are of the reflection matrix of the atom. Okay, so this is one of the elements one needs to put into the previous formula. And then it's next one is a joke for Israel. So so this will be from TGTG to GTG. So basically, if you put that formula before into the expression for the energy, we have this exact expression of the energy of interaction between the atom and the surface as an integral of some properties of the atom, a double integral on the transverse momentum of a field, and something related to the matrix elements of the surface. So this is a GTG, because one of the T's we have calculated explicitly, which is the atomic one. So this will be one of the G's, the other G, and here's our T. So this is something that we have derived. This is an exact expression for interaction between the atom and any surface in terms of the reflection operators of the surface. And it can be written in different ways. In the literature, also appears, as I said at the beginning, written in terms of a Green function of a surface. So this is basically a representation of a Green function in terms of plane waves. Okay, so what remains to be done is to calculate the reflection matrices of a surface for any surface and any material properties. This is a tough problem, so I'm going to start by telling you about perturbation theory. So the idea is that we assume that the surface is almost flat and has some local deviation from flat surface, and h will be small, it will be the smallest length k in the problem. And therefore, you can expand the reflection operator in powers of h to zeroth order. You get the usual Fresnel equations in terms of the electric polarizability, electric permittivity of the surface, frequency dependent. And to first order, you can show that the first order elements are proportional to the Fourier profile of the surface, h, times some first order reflection operators that depend on the properties of the surface. And this have been calculated in the literature some years ago. So basically, one can take that information for this problem. So once you have all that, you can calculate the force on the atom. And it will have two components. One is a normal force, usually attractive. But then, because this has a non-trivial geometry, there will be a lateral force. Okay, so our idea is try to give some ideas of how to measure this lateral force and how to compute it. So the normal force is a normal force that we have talked before. It's given by the usual Fresnel expressions. The lateral force is given by a convolution of the profile of the surface times this response function g that depends both on the transverse momentum of the fluctuations on the surface and on the distance between the surface and the atom. Okay? So it has this form. And all the information about what the surface is, what the optical properties are contained in this reflection operator, R. Yes?
What's breaking the symmetry? I don't understand why there's a lateral force, right? You're an atom on top of a surface, right?
Well, but the surface is not planar. It has some profile.
Right, but shouldn't there be just as much on average from the side?
No. Suppose the surface is, I don't know, like a sinusoidal, which I'm going to talk later on. Okay? What you think is true if the atom is very, very, very close to the surface. Because it will see a local surface, it will see a local flat plane. And therefore, we don't know where to go. But if it's not so close, it will see a local potential which has a minimum in one direction and a maximum in another direction. So the gradient will be anisotropic. So it will try to go to the minimum energy. Okay? I will show you now some numerics. Okay, so again, as I said, this is a perturbative calculation of the energy, and is valid as long as the h is the smallest length k in the problem. So smaller than the smaller distance, smaller than lambda p, smaller than everything. Okay, so sometimes people at this point say, well, what is known and what are the approximation people usually do? So people like to talk about PFA, proximity force, or pairwise summation. In the context of an atom close to a surface, these are the following. PFA would be, you have an atom, you have a surface which has a corrugation wavelength very, very large, okay? So the atom sees a local surface with a renormalized distance, okay? So in PFA, there will be a force because it's not actually flat, but the calculation is just taking the plane case with a renormalized distance. The other approximation that people usually do in this context is the pairwise summation. So you replace the surface by a bunch of atoms, and you assume that the force is additive. So you calculate the atom-atoms interaction on all this volume, and you get a force. So what we do is neither of them. What we do is exact to first-order perturbation theory. And in order to estimate how bad these approximations are, we compute these ratios, this rho, which is a ratio of the corresponding response functions, the exact versus PFA, and PFA corresponds to k equals 0, because that means very, very large corrugations. Or you can also calculate the pairwise response function g, and then we compute this ratio also. So this is a plot of these ratios as a function of kc times z, okay? For perfect reflectors, first order perturbation theory, one is the exact calculation that we have done, and the others are PFA or pairwise. And what you see here is that, in general, PFA overestimates and PWS underestimates. Same happens in the case of customer case, as Thorsten has shown.
So the depth of the ratio is
respect to what? To H, the local...
H with respect to what?
With respect to all the other length scales in the problem. With respect to the plasma wavelength, with respect to the distance between the atom and the surface, with respect to the lambda atomic, okay. At the end, I will talk just briefly about the new results we have about the exact computation of this for any orders.
Yes. I didn't understand your answer.
Are
you saying H over lambda is the correction?
H over lambda, I mean H.
When you say linear, just in normal language, that's what it is.
Yes. But lambda is all possible length scales in the problem.
I don't have a lot of that, and lambda is big compared to.
Exactly.
Okay. Usually, if you have, let's say, two surfaces, you can separate the problem in SFP polarization.
Yes.
And does this, in this case, it seems to be no longer possible, or is this, due to the perturbative?
In this case, it's possible, right.
But because you assume the deformation is
small. Exactly. So you talk about S and P or T or TM with respect to the plane of incidence, with respect to the
yeah.
plane. You can also, I'll talk later on, but you can also do exact computations for uniaxial.
Yeah.
Beyond perturbation theory, including real materials, and we have done that. Okay, so once we have all this, now it's a matter of putting everything into the formula. First of all, we need a dynamic polarizability. This was given by us by Jim Babb from ITAMP for rubidium. So this is the expression. Then you all need to go to these papers by Serge, Paolo, and company to get the first order reflection operators in terms of real, in terms of the reflection, the Fresnel TE transmission and reflection operators. And then you need optical data for different materials. So for example, this is epsilon along imaginary frequency for gold, silicon, and fused silica, computed from Palik's book. And then you put everything into the formulas and you obtain an expression for the energy. So now, how to measure this? So, David was saying, so if you have an atom close to a surface and the surface has a non-trivial profile, there will be some non-trivial gradients of the field, and therefore will be some force, okay? Now, if we want to see deviations from PFA in particular, it's good to have this kind of surface, which my wife, and I will say this to her because she will watch it later on. This is what she likes to say, that it's a chocolate bar. So basically, if you put an atom close to the chocolate bar, it will see a flat, okay? So it will see locally no gradients, and therefore PFA would predict zero force, zero lateral force. By the exact calculation, and also PWS, predict that there is a lateral force, even in this case. And that's what we want to measure. So, and the nice thing about atoms, as compared to standard Casimir experiments, is the atom is very, very small, so it's a local probe of the field rather than a global average probe of the field. Okay? So, so our idea was to take such a profile, which is this wedge. So given these parameters for the wedge, so the opening, the pitch, you can do Fourier transform of this uniaxial corrugation. And then since the energy at first order is linear in the profile through this response function, it's trivial to calculate for HK and then sum all the results, right? So that's what we did. So here we are plotting. So on the bottom is the surface, the profile, okay, as a function of distance. And on the top is the potential that the atom sees. Okay, this is for very, very short separations, and this is for larger separations. So when the atom is very close to this grooved corrugated surface, what it sees is basically a map, an exact map of the surface. So the potential maps the surface exactly, like in AFMs. So the atom will try to go to the minimum of the energy, therefore go to the regions above the plateau, where the distance is smaller, and therefore that's a minimum energy state. If the atom goes further away, the potential starts to be different to the local potential, and at large separations it sees an ineffective sinusoidal corrugation with an effective amplitude. Okay? Well, this is for perfect reflectors, but the same thing happens for real materials. Now, so how to measure this? Two possibilities, well, many, but I'm going to talk about two. One is this BEC oscillator that we talked at the beginning. So here we put an elongated BEC above this corrugated surface with axis perpendicular, parallel to the corrugation lines. Okay, so instead of making the BEC oscillate up to the top and bottom, like in Cornell, one can think of making it oscillate sideways, so perpendicular to the corrugation lines. Okay, so in this way, if one can measure the center of mass as a function of lateral position for different heights, one can infer local shifts of the frequency of the lateral frequency, and therefore measure the second derivative of the lateral potential. Okay. Okay. Another way that one can think of is to use a BEC as a local density probe, like it's done in atom chips. So this is a picture of an experiment that Schmidt-Meyer did in Germany. So basically, you have a wire here in yellow or green that is conducting a current, but the wire has some local defects. So the wire generates a local changing magnetic field. Okay, so it's not translational invariant. So on top of the wire, you put an elongated BEC, and if the BEC is quasi one-dimensional, it's possible to show that the local potential of the BEC, B of X, let's call it, is related to the local one-dimensional density through this formula. So if you measure density by taking a picture of the BEC, you can infer the local potential that the BEC sees. So if we are thinking now in Casimir experiments, the BEC will see a local harmonic trap plus a local Casimir polder. And therefore, if I measure this guy, I can measure the local Casimir polder. So the idea that we have is to put the BEC now sideways, so perpendicular to the corrugation lines. So the density of the BEC along this direction should vary because there is a gradient of the potential in that direction, and therefore you can measure that, then you can infer the Casimir polder. And well, we did some estimations and it seems reasonable. But the other method with the oscillator seems better. So I'm almost done, almost. So these are data that we calculated, theoretical data. For a single atom, above a single rubidium atom, above a surface which can be gold, silicon, or fused silica, so this includes real optical data, for the frequency shift, the lateral frequency shift. And this is a shift as a function of k times z. Okay, this is for a sinusoidal correlation. No, this is for the group. Okay, and kc here is the inverse of the wavelength of the period. So what you see here is that if I am very, very small values of distance, so the atom very close to the plateau, there is no frequency shift, so these functions go to zero, and that's because if I'm very close, I see a flat surface above a plateau, and therefore no gradients. As soon as I go further away, I start to see the structure, and therefore the shift starts to grow. And we believe that the growth is enough to be seen in this kind of experiments like Cornell's. And this is a comparison of a single atom to the BEC. Basic result is basically the BEC, as it increases in its radius, the Thomas Fermi radius, the effect gets bigger and bigger. So you put all numbers into this expression, some experimental numbers, we believe that with a very tight BEC of around 1 micron, about 3 microns from the surface, it should be possible to measure these lateral Casimir-Polder forces. Okay? So in Los Alamos, we are trying to do an experiment on that. So this is a picture of a surface that was built by Mike Blaine at Sandia Labs with this square corrugated surface of different materials. And the idea would be to put this thing into a BEC apparatus and try to measure such an effect, which is highly non-trivial. So I told you a little bit before that we have also done some exact analytical results. I think Ho-Woo Chan was already here, so he talked about his recent experiment between a metallic sphere and a corrugated surface of silicon with very deep trenches, where they measure for the first time large corrections to PFA and PWS in Casimir experiments. So the theory for this, one can take in the model of ideal reflectors like Thorsen did some years ago, and there's a recent paper by the French group where they included real optical data, real materials, and exact solution for this problem with these deep square corrugated surfaces. So what we have done is to compute now exactly the Casimir polar force between an atom and a corrugated uniaxial surface, including real optical data. Hopefully at one point someone will do an experiment and we'll be able to compare our theory with an experiment.
Exact, that's not the cross-polar.
No, exact, it's a non-perturbative. Exact analytical result for uniaxial corrugated surfaces. The easiest thing to do, which we have done, is to do it with square corrugation. But even for very deep, it's basically the same thing as Valerie and Astrid have done, but now for the atom surface case. So as a summary of this last part, so the nice thing about atoms is that they are open a way to measure quantum effects in regimes where typical Casimir experiments cannot, like measuring temperature effects or measuring large distance effects. The other thing is that they are local probes, so they measure local quantities and not average quantities as in typical Casimir experiments. And there are many possibilities and many experiments that one can think of in order to measure large deviations to PFA and PWS, and applications in atom chips, and so on. So these are two references where the last part three is described. So, thank you.
Would it be fundamentally possible to make, when you have an atom above a surface, to make a kind of redshift? Like they do with vortices, that they move preferably in one of the two directions, in one direction?
I don't think it's fundamental. I think it should be possible. So you mean an asymmetric potential? Yes.
In such a way that the atom wants the moment.
Yeah. In principle, it's possible.
Instead of a real surface, what if you put a light sheet next to oscillating beads? Should you see these steps in effects? If you put an intense light sheet, would this act as a surface?
But it would be, it would be translation symmetry along this direction, right?
Well, with the light sheet, they can do lots. They can actually put roughness.
Okay. Yeah.
So if you could do it with that, I would imagine that you could manipulate light sheets much easier than you can manipulate real surfaces, right? They can put all these different types of things.
Yes. Yes.
So you would see these similar types.
Yes.
Have to make electromagnetism non-linear. As long as
your
position principle holds, then.
The dependency on distance will be completely different, right? Because the light sheet will be like cosine or sine of kx. The potential that the light sheet sees, right? It's an optical lattice you want.
That's what you wanted to do. He wants to do is to replace the substrate with the light sheet.
Right, yeah.
Right.
And then not put the optical lattice immersed in a condensate.
No, I see, yeah. But I want to say, what's the interaction between the atom and the optical and the sheet, optical sheet?
So then what you're looking at is not how the atom is responding to the modulation, but how an additional electromagnetic fluctuation responds to the modulation. And what I'm saying is, as long as superposition principle holds, the additional electromagnetic field does not see the intense electromagnetic
field. But
this will only be broken from very high intense
non-linear effects.
Right.
You need nonlinear effects in vacuum. That's even harder. It's
even harder to create that vacuum.
Yeah, it's hard.
Very intense.
So you can tell your wife that atoms are attracted to chocolate.
Yes.
Only women.
Only atoms.
Okay.
What did you say?